Welcome to the Real Estate Pod from St John's Chambers. I'm Brittany Pierce, and with me is Joss Knight, and we're both members of the Chancery and Commercial team here at St John's. Now, the aim of this podcast is to share our insights into different aspects of property law. So you can expect these podcasts to provide an introduction to different topics that are commonly encountered, to delve into some of the more difficult problems that we come across, to discuss practical matters that often crop up in this line of work, and also to provide you with case updates. In this episode, Joss and I are going to be discussing misrepresentation in the context of residential conveyancing. So we're going to give you a brief introduction to the area. I'll discuss one of my recent cases, highlighting some of the difficulties that can arise with misrep claims, and also looking at the standard conditions of sale and how they might aid a claim. Joss is going to discuss some of his work, relevant case law, and also a commonly encountered exclusion clause known as a William-Sindall clause. So Joss, handing over to you, can you give us a quick introduction to misrep?
Thanks very much, Brittany, and thanks for having me along on what is rapidly becoming the Brittany Pierce Property Podcast. It's great to be here. I'm going to very quickly whiz through a little bit on the very basics of misrep and then talk a little bit about the particular factors which relate to property misrep. I am not going to take you through the Misrepresentation Act because it's just the most mind-numbingly boring and badly drafted. Most of this will be very familiar to the vast majority of you, but it's helpful, I think, just to whiz through very quickly. Essential elements. Number one, we need a statement of fact or law, not an opinion, to qualify. It needs to be made by party A or party A's agent, and two, party B. Thirdly, the statement has to be untrue, obviously. Fourthly, the statement has to induce party B into entering into the contract. Number five, party B has to suffer loss as a consequence. You will know that there are three types of misrepresentation: fraudulent, negligent, and innocent. Fraudulent misrepresentation requires additional criteria to be met over and above the false representation. You've got to prove it's made knowingly or made without belief to its truth or recklessly as to its truth. Negligent misrepresentation is where there's a breach of duty owed by party A to take reasonable care that the representation is accurate in a breach of that duty. Alternatively, and this is a change brought in by the Misrepresentation Act, expanded under Section 2.1, if no duty of care exists, negligent misrep can still occur where the representation was made carelessly or without reasonable grounds. And it's going to be particularly important in a property context. And finally, innocent misrep, as the name would suggest, is neither fraudulent or negligent. Important consequences as to which one you fall into for remedies. So fraudulent, you're entitled to rescission and damages. Negligent, and this is again the impact of the 1967 Act, you also can claim rescission and damages. Innocent, that's a different one. Rescission, or at the discretion of the court, damages in lieu of rescission, but you can't have both. And Brittany, I think your case in particular has some useful discussion on the question of the usefulness of rescission or availability of rescission in a property context.
Absolutely. I'll delve into that in due course.
Yeah. Just very briefly before you do, a couple of particular features of misrep in a property context. The most obvious, of course, is that we're dealing with written contracts. This is not people down the pub agreeing things over a pint or any kind of oral terms of a contract. We have formalities in property conveyancing. Things have to be in writing. And the most obvious consequences of that is that exclusion clauses apply if they're incorporated into the wording of the contract. we'll come on to the standard conditions in a moment, but very typically you will have something in the contract that says something like, the buyer hereby confirms that the buyer has inspected the property and has entered into this contract on the basis of such inspection, no reliance on any representation or warranty made on behalf of the sellers, save for the written replies of the seller to the property information form, TA6, or the fixtures and fittings form, the TA10, or any other property information forms, and so thereby excluding anything else that sits outside that. Those clauses will always end, do not exclude liability for fraud and recklessness, typically, of course, because fraud unravels all. I mean, the basic idea behind that is you can't lie through your teeth and then be able to rely on exclusion clauses to get you out of trouble after the event. And you also get these under the standard conditions of sale. There's a draft special condition that says neither party can rely on any representation made by the other unless made in writing by the other or his conveyancer, but this does not exclude liability for fraud or recklessness. That's a little bit narrower in terms of what it excludes than the very broad one I was outlining previously, because it's still anything that's in writing but excludes anything oral. Final point about property misrep. One of the primary reasons people are often upset having bought a property and experiencing buyer remorse or are angry at the seller is that the property they get is in a worse condition than they realised, and you know, understandably, they're aggrieved at this situation. It's very hard to rely on misrep in relation to complaints about condition generally. The standard conditions of sale at 3.2.1 say the buyer accepts the property in the physical state it is in at the date of the contract unless the seller is building or converting it. And there's a useful bit in the judgment of a case called Thorpe and Abbott. We'll put the citation in the show notes. And the judge there said the starting point in a conveyancing transaction is still caveat emptor. It is for the buyer to satisfy himself about the state and condition of a property and as to any other matters he may consider relevant to its purpose. Again, obvious exceptions to that are fraud. But worth noting that the standard property information form, the TA6 and the fixtures and fittings, TA10, do not ask about the condition of the property. And there's good reason for that. It's an intolerable burden on the seller to be able to know this. And you, when you are buying a property, instruct a surveyor, typically, and it is the surveyor's job to reassure you about the property and its condition. And if you have concerns about that, then your recourse is very often to that surveyor or potentially against the architects. Certain circumstances, perhaps a contractual claim against the builders. But unless the seller is building or converting it, condition misrep claims are pretty difficult. Final thing I want to say before I hand back to you, Brittany, is just to talk about that difference between innocent and negligent misrep and how one falls on one side of the line or the other. And you referenced William Sindall clauses. And just to remind anyone or in fact let people know about who don't know about the impact of William Sindall refers to the case of William Sindall PLC in Cambridgeshire County Council. And that was a case that really put the frighteners on people acting for sellers because the judgment of Lord Hoffman said that it's well established that a statement that a vendor is not aware of a defect in title carries with it an implied representation that he has taken reasonable steps to ascertain whether any exists. And then the crucial bit is the judge goes on to say, well, what does that really mean in practice? What are you required to do? He said this may require him, in the first instance, to examine his title deeds and other records, inspect the property and obtain legal advice. If there's anything to put him on inquiry as to the existence of a defect, he may have to pursue the matter further by questioning others or examining their documents. So suddenly, you get to a stage where you say, well, I wasn't aware of anything, and therefore I said under the property information form, you know, not to the best of my knowledge are any of these things affecting the property. And the impact of William Sindall is says, well, no, actually there's an obligation on you to potentially do really quite a lot to uncover any issues which might require inclusion within the property information forms. And that will move you from potentially what you might consider an innocent misrepresentation to a negligent misrepresentation and all the consequences that that brings as regards remedies and in particular damages. Now, Brittany, let's go back to you because I know you've got a very exciting case that you were recently involved in which dealt with a lot of these issues. So go on, tell us what it was all about, what went down.
Thanks, Joss. All right, I'll start by setting the scene. Picture this, beautiful country house on a hill, surrounded by woodland with panoramic views over the countryside.
Dreamy.
It is dreamy, or at least that's what my clients thought. That's what my clients bought. It was expensive. Think high six figures. And they were buying towards the tail end of COVID. And at that point, you might remember that demand for these types of properties far outstripped supply.
Green space. Everyone was talking about green space.
Everybody escaping London and moving to the countryside. Plenty of offers were being put in, and my clients ended up having to pay sort of $50,000 over the asking price to secure the house. And the reason I raised that is because the fact of how the market was at that time also became relevant to the expert's assessment later as to what the diminution in value was likely to be and whether or not actually it was reduced, because plenty of people who wanted properties like this would simply have overlooked these issues just to get their hands on a property. Now, the key to understanding the dispute I was dealing with is to know that, unsurprisingly, this house came with a driveway. And a government department had a right of way over this driveway, and they'd reserved the right of way before they sold the house in the 60s. And the right of way that they reserved also extended to their agents and their licensees. That's not particularly surprising. That's pretty common wording when it comes to easements. And whilst there were public footpaths nearby, the public also used the driveway to get from the local town into the woods. So before completion, the sellers had said a number of things. Some of these things had been said orally, but importantly for us, they were all repeated in writing. The important bits were, they said the public's usage was very low. They also said that the public's right to use the driveway was essentially a revocable license controlled by whomever owns the house. Now, they didn't quite put it like that. What they said was there was a permissive access which wasn't legally binding on the owners of the property. But that's, in essence, in legal terms, what they were saying was that there was a revocable license. And we also knew that they'd rejected purchase offers from people who wanted to terminate the public access. It seems like the sellers had sort of enjoyed the public coming up and through the drive and the community aspect of that. So my clients move in. They find that the usage is far higher than they were expecting. And they also thought it was pretty intrusive. And it really had this dampening effect on their enjoyment of this property. They had at least 20 people a day, often double that, sometimes hundreds of people, sometimes as part of fun runs or organised walks, going up and down this driveway into the woods. And this was all through the day during daylight hours. And in the end, what they had to do to show the usage was to put up security cameras and sort of count the number of people passing over the driveway so that they could show what the usage actually was. So as well as the number of people actually using the drive, the usage itself wasn't without difficulties. Litter was being dropped by some walkers. Some walkers would wander off of the driveway into the garden. There wasn't any barrier between them, but they'd sort of wander off into the garden to better enjoy these beautiful views that had encouraged my clients to buy their house. And those walkers with dogs sometimes had their dogs off lead. Sometimes those off lead dogs would wander off into the garden, do what dogs do, and perhaps the owners were not being so attentive with their dog poo bags as they ought to have been. So suddenly, this secluded house on the hill did not feel so secluded anymore. Pretty predictably, the first thing they tried to do was to end the public's use. They thought they were entitled to terminate the public access. That's in essence what they had been told and what they'd been led to believe. So they informed the public via sort of signs and social media posts that this is what they're going to do, and it causes absolute uproar because it became a subject of interest in local politics. The local councillor received dozens, I think almost 100 complaints about the closure of this access through the driveway. Local news organisations picked it up. Social media posts were made and plenty of comments going on in sort of local Facebook groups. The public, some were supportive of sort of my client's position and understood. Others became quite unpleasant, as well as sort of the diatribe that ended up being left on these posts in social media conversations. You also had real world consequences. There were some pretty unpleasant interactions on the driveway itself. My clients had dead animals left on their doorstep. They had garden ornaments being moved in the middle of the night. And they ended up being totally ostracised in a community where everyone tends to know everyone else. One of the other things that happened is that presumably angry locals contact this government department to complain. That government department gets in touch with my clients saying, well, as far as we're concerned, the public are our licensees. They're entitled to use this driveway. You can't stop them. Which came as something of a shock. So we get an expert involved because one of the first things I said was, before we look at this any further, how much has this sort of knocked off the value of the house? Because if it hasn't knocked that much off, it's not worth pursuing any further, even if it's having a detrimental impact on your enjoyment. And our expert came back and said, this could be up to £150,000. So it's worth pursuing. Now, we ended up pursuing the vendors for misrepresentation. They got their own expert who said, no, zero, maybe 50.
Funny that.
So there was a... Funny that. And one of the things that they were really relying on was the strength of the market at the time. But we had a pretty large range of what the potential diminution in value was going to shake out as. And to start the ball rolling, we focused on sort of the best misrep arguments. And these were, one, you said that usage was very low. No, it isn't. And two, you said that the public's usage was sort of revocable at our election. No, it isn't.
And these were, sorry to jump across you, Brittany, these were in writing in email correspondence, not in property information forms, but they were there between solicitors.
It was actually, it was in a series of documents. So the sellers had produced a sort of Q&A information form about the property. They hadn't done that specifically for my clients. They'd done that for all prospective purchasers. And they put together a multi-page sort of document about the neighbours and the government department's usage, which was very low. Sort of occasionally they'd drive over with a van and it would be, so years might go by before without seeing them. And it was all sorts of what the local community is like, what there is going on. The sort of thing that if you were a purchaser, you might be absolutely delighted to have all of this information provided to you. But that was provided. Then the property information forms were provided and they referred back to and incorporated this document, as well as sort of summarising it within the form. And then a statutory declaration was also provided, because one of the things my clients had been really concerned about was that it would be said this driveway was a public right of way. And that's something that they wanted to head off. So there was a lot of discussion about the nature of the public's usage. In the end, no one was contending it was a public right of way, but it did mean that there'd been a lot of discussion at the pre-action stage about the public and this driveway. And the statutory declaration was also incorporated into the contract itself. So written down, plenty of places. And the way that this case shook out was we've ended up settling it, and we settled it at mediation pre-issue. And we did that, managed that by essentially sending out a very robust letter before action, sending out a draft particulars of claim, really spelling out what the complaints were, providing this evidence about usage, and then getting everyone to the table as soon as possible. Now, as I've said, the allegations on misrep, we focused on sort of the volume and the nature of the use. But one of the other arguments that we had in our back pocket was to say, well, if you look at the standard conditions of sale, we're also entitled to damages or rescission on this basis.
Contractual now, claim.
Absolutely. And it's pretty handy, because some people sort of suggest that the standard conditions of sale are just misrep in another word. And that's not the case. There are a lot of elements that are common to the two of them. But actually, it is another string to your bow when you have cases such as this, because in essence, what the standard conditions provide is that where a sort of statement has been made, which is wrong, and that sort of provides that there's a material difference between the description and the value of the property as represented and as is, there's an entitlement to damages. And there's an entitlement to rescission where there's fraud or recklessness, or where the property differs substantially. It goes on to say differs substantially in quantity, quality or tenure. There's remarkably little about what in fact is meant by quantity, quality or tenure. But in our case, I wasn't particularly concerned, because I thought, well, potentially it comes under sort of the quality of tenure, because we were looking at the nature of a right burdening the land, and that's how we were going to get into that. But realistically, I anticipated we were more in the damages side of things anyway, in which case what we had to show was a sort of material difference between description of the property and how it was described and what was actually the case, and that's slightly easier to do. So there are some overlaps there with misrep. So you've got to show there's been this statement. You've got to show that it's wrong. But you also take a lot of other elements out. You don't have to show reliance, for instance. And you also avoid some of the quirks of misrep. You went through earlier things like, well, if it's fraudulent, you get this. And if it's negligent, you get this. And if it's innocent, it's that. Well, for instance, with innocent misrepresentation, Section 2.2 of the 1967 Act provides that the court can award damages in lieu of rescission. And there have been a number of cases, and how the law is shaken out is that you're only entitled to damages under Section 2.2 if, at the date of trial, rescission is still available. And that's a big point of concern in property transactions, because you might not get to trial for 18 months, 2 years, until after you've purchased the property. And that's if you act very promptly. And by the time you're that far down the line, can you actually rescind? Mm. There's a question mark over whether you can rescind so as to get your stamp duty back after a year. There's also things like, well, what's happened to the money that's been paid? Is that capable of rescinding? Can that money be returned? Is there a mortgage over the property now? Have other rights being granted, a sort of a lease or something like that? Can the property be returned? So there's a real concern, something you've got to be very careful with if you think you're looking at an innocent misrep argument. There's a real chance that the court comes, sort of gets to its conclusion, gives its judgment and says, yes, there was a misrep, but it was blameless, i.e. it was innocent. But I don't think that I can award rescission at this point, so you're not entitled to damages either.
Mm.
And what was the point of the claim? At that point, you've sunk tens of thousands into legal costs, but you've not actually really achieved anything. So getting back to the standard conditions of sale, brilliant thing about them is that when you're using them for a ground of claim, you avoid that concern. So I'd really recommend that if you're a solicitor who's looking to pursue a misrep claim in a residential property conveyancing context, you also have a look at the standard conditions of sale, as they're a helpful string to your bow. Before I hand back to you, Joss, I think what I'm going to do is sort of draw the threads together and give those people who are listening a few things to think about. For instance, if you're going to pursue a misrep claim, what specifically has gone wrong? In a sentence, what has gone wrong? And do you have a risk that it's a statement of opinion rather than a statement of fact? So, for instance, in my case, there might have been an argument about whether the statement about usage, for instance, was a statement of opinion. I thought it probably wasn't, but the point was arguable if we'd have got to court. Can you prove reliance? One of the things in my case was that some of the statements that were made were in documents that we didn't ask for. The information had been proffered voluntarily. Doesn't mean that we didn't rely on it, but it's more difficult to prove reliance in that circumstance than if you specifically ask the question and it's the response you're complaining about. Can you prove the statement is wrong? A lot of cases, that's a pretty binary yes or no answer. Does this house have dry rot? No, it doesn't. Oh, yes, it does. Here's this expert report. It wasn't quite so straightforward in my case. Things were a little more nuanced. What does usage is very low mean? Well, very low might mean different things to different people. There's a pretty reasonable range of scenarios there. It doesn't mean that we couldn't pursue it. It just meant that we'd have to persuade judge that any reasonable person could say that very low is between this and this level of usage, but our level of usage was way outside that range, and therefore the statement is wrong. We'd also have to have proved that the public were licensees and that they had a right of access we couldn't interrupt. So again, that sort of added litigation risk, because at that point you're going to have to get into the construction of the easement. So proving that the statement is wrong is not necessarily straightforward. Once you do all of that, you've got to go through and figure out what your actual loss was. We wanted rescission, but we probably weren't going to get rescission. We were probably going to get damages. And those damages were going to depend on really which expert the court preferred. It could have been anywhere between nothing and £150,000. Joss, I'm going to hand this back to you because I've rambled on long enough and I'm conscious there's a few other things that you want to talk about, so I shouldn't monopolise this podcast altogether. I'll resist the urge.
No, thanks, Brittany. Super interesting. And I guess slightly unusual in the sense that you've got this sort of freewheeling Q&A document, which has a whole bunch of representations made in, which at the time the vendors were like, this will bring in the buyers, this will get everyone interested. But of course, slightly creating a rod for their own back. And it's the kind of thing you as solicitors acting for sellers think, oh my God, well, suddenly we're making all these other representations and promises potentially that may be relied on and may come back to bite
absolutely.
Our clients.
It's something that I think conveyancing solicitors, if you're listening and you're acting for sellers, are you allowing your clients to create unnecessary risks at this point? Because a lot of the things that were being said didn't necessarily need to be said. They hadn't been asked by purchasers to put this information together. We might well have still ended up in a dispute. We probably would have in this case. But the sellers certainly made things more difficult for themselves because of everything that had been written down, which hadn't been requested.
But I guess the other thing is, you know, I talked a little bit about at the beginning about, you know, a lot of contracts containing quite broad exclusion clauses, essentially saying, unless it's fraud, you only get to rely on the TA6 and the TA10. And it would have been interesting in your case if there had been a clause like that within the contract. But this very prominent document that goes back and forth, and, you know, are you then restricted just to being able to argue fraud and leaving behind anything else? But then, you know, I guess that's where your contractual claim potentially comes in.
Yeah, and also, and one of the things that had been done is because the sellers had created this document before they'd put together sort of the seller's property information form, was that when it came to the property information form, they provided a tiny summary, because there's not that much space on the forms if you have to provide a lot of information. So they'd provide a tiny sort of one-sentence summary, and then they'd incorporate the form. Oh. And they'd bring that in, and they'd refer... So they brought that entire sort of... half a dozen pages of documentation and maps and photographs and all that sort of thing. And they sort of brought all of that into the form, as it were. But certainly if they hadn't produced that in the first case, they might well have said a lot less in the property information form.
Super interesting. I know one of the cases that you relied on, one of the reported judgments in that was Morgan and Pooley, because it has some quite similar facts in the sense that it was something that was happening on the neighbouring land that suddenly the purchasers weren't aware of and was impinging on their right, their ability to enjoy their own property, having bought it, and they didn't know it was going to affect them. But that very much was a TA6 property information form case. And the question, or the relevant question in that, was, have you either sent or received any letters or notices which affect your property or the neighbouring property in any way? Brackets, for example, from or to neighbours, the council or government department. And they answered no to that question, or the sellers answered no to that question. And it's important to note a couple of things here. Have you sent or received any letters or notices? Isn't a William Sindel type case about going off to make reasonable investigations about this, that and the other? It is a binary question. Have you or have you not received this? Right. That's issue one. Issue two, if they had received or sent anything of this nature, then it's not going to be an innocent misrep kind of case. You know, either it's fraudulent because they're just saying, well, we don't want to disclose this, or it's, you know, very negligent in the sense that they just haven't bothered to, you know, recollect or go back through their documents or anything of that nature. It's very unlikely just to be entirely innocent. And you know, they answered no to this question. And obviously that was, well, was it wrong? The sellers said yes, because every other neighbour in the vicinity had received notice of what one of the third party neighbours was going to be doing. And on the facts, there were various notices that were affixed to fence posts about what was going to happen at this property. And the insinuation, or the allegation that was made, was that the vendors must have seen these notices either through their own letterbox or when they were plastered up all over the place. But they said
not an unreasonable point to make.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, given they adduced lots of evidence from all the other neighbours who said, yeah, we got this through the post, we got through this through our letterbox, etc. And we saw the signs everywhere. Couldn't miss them. And the sellers said, no, we got nothing through our letterbox and we didn't see anything affixed to any fence posts. And surprisingly, one might say that succeeded, or that defence succeeded in court. And as a question of pure fact, the judge found that they had not received this through their letterbox and they had not seen the notices affixed to fence posts, and therefore in essence, they got away with it. But one of the really interesting things about that case is the contract included what's known as a William Sindall clause, which essentially tries to remove the risk that one has as a result of the decision in that case about having to go off or having an obligation to go off and undertake all these kinds of searches. And it said in this case, in light of the decision in William Sindall PLC in Cambridge County Council, it is agreed and declared that the reply to any inquiry or information supplied in any property information form is given to the best knowledge and belief of the seller, and neither the seller nor his legal representative has made any further inquiries into such matters, such as, but without limitation, conducting a site inspection, making specific inquiries or statutory authorities or utilities, and the replies are therefore given on that basis. So basically saying, this is what I know, I'm not going to go off and have a look. If you want to go off and have a look yourself, obviously you're entitled to, but don't come crying to me afterwards if what I've said here happens not to be true. And the judge in Morgan and Pooley spent some time investigating whether these clauses could be relied on, whether they were enforceable, and whether the court could ignore them. And the judge went through and looked at the various authorities on non-reliance clauses and concluded that in this particular case, the William Sindall clause was enforceable, it could be relied upon, and therefore the obligations on the vendor were that much less. I think it's worth just sort of running through the reasons why very briefly. The judge says, in my view, there's a difference between two types of situation. The first is where the non-reliance clause is one of many clauses in a long contract prepared by lawyers, which the parties to it may have limited opportunity to read in detail beforehand. In that situation, it might well be argued successfully that the party relying on the clause should not be allowed to do so because the clause falls within the contract when it is avoided for misrepresentation. The second type of situation is like the one here. As I've already explained, the special conditions were known to Mrs. Morgan, that's the purchasers, or at least to their solicitors well before they entered into the contract, but probably after they had seen the property information form. It was a short document, conditions were printed in large type, easily readable. This taken together with the early notice that the sellers were entering into the transaction on the basis of the William Sindall clause, leads to the conclusion that in the circumstances of this case, the non-reliance clause should be given effect. So there we go. Case specific, I think, is the thing to take away from that. But if you are going to try and incorporate one of these into the contract, obviously, first and foremost, the other side have got to agree and not object. But also, it can't be slipped in at the end of a long-form contract that the purchasers are unlikely to read. It's got to be there front and centre. Helpful, I suppose, to even draw their attention to it specifically in some form of correspondence.
In my experience, I'll just jump in there, because I also had a William Sindall clause in this case. In my experience, they get thrown in the special conditions.
Yeah. Yeah. And as was indeed in this case, I think. And so, yeah, they're obviously a very useful thing if you're a vendor to avoid the kind of difficulties when a dispute arises as to what you should have done or what lengths you should have gone to. The other thing that was useful in Morgan and Pooley was that the judge looked at the standard conditions in the particular clause that you were referring to, Brittany, that brings in the contractual claim. It's clause 7 of the standard conditions. And it says, if there's a plan or statement or in the contract or in the negotiations leading to it, or was misleading and inaccurate due to an error or omission, the remedies available are as follows. Where there's a material difference between the description or value of the property as represented and as it is, the buyer is entitled to damages, right? And the judge makes the point that you made, Brittany, that this does not require reliance on the representation made. It requires the representation to have been made and for it to be false. but it is limited to specific types of representation, right? So it's where there is a material difference between the description or the value of the property. So the judge said that, look, if this can be enforceable, even in circumstances where you don't have to prove reliance, that means that the clause itself should be given a narrow rather than a wide construction. He says, I therefore consider that the statement must amount to some form of description of the property or statement as to its value, because there has to be a material difference between the property as described and the property as it is. Alternatively, a material difference between the value as described and the value as it is. And going back to the facts of Morgan and Pooley, the alleged misrepresentation was about the receipt of a notice. And the judge said, well, that's not a description of the property. That is a factual statement as to I have received a notice or I haven't received a notice. It's not about a description of the property. And so the only way that this clause could then be relied upon by the purchasers was if it amounts to a statement as to value. And the judge says, well, this is all a bit unclear. It's less clear what a statement to value means in this context. But he says one example might be a statement that a comparable house was sold for X, implying that the property was worth X, when in fact the comparable property was sold for X to Y. So a fairly niche possible representation.
And then you've got to have an argument about what's being implied and whether it should be implied. And
yeah, absolutely. And he says, by contrast, I cannot see how a statement that the vendor has never received a letter affecting a property is a statement as to the value of the property being sold. So I guess what you take from this is the point that you made, Brittany, is that Clause 7 is really useful when you're straddling that edge of innocent and negligent misrepresentation, or there's question marks over reliance. But by the same token, because there are fewer things for you to prove, what Morgan and Pooley says is we are going to interpret this clause much more restrictively, and the representation is going to have to be about a description of the property or a description of its value, and that is not a broad question. That is a narrow question. But a really useful case, because there aren't too many cases on property misrep that have been reported. I do just want to talk about one more, because it's quite a recent one, decision of Mr. Justice Zaccaroli. It's called Rossa and Pacifico Limited. And very briefly, property is a leasehold flat. It's the first and the second floor, so not the ground floor. Second floor is the top of the building, right? So three stories in this building, ground first, second, and this property is the first and the second. Pacifico Limited is the developer. They modernised the property. They sold it to Ms. Rossa as a two-bed property, right? So that's the representation. This is a two-bed property. Both bedrooms are on the second floor. Filling in the TA6, the director of Pacifico, in fact, lived in Australia, had never visited the property himself at all, said that there was no breach of planning or work carried out without the necessary consents. And it was accepted by the judge that the director, when he made that statement, believed it was the case. He wasn't aware of any breaches of planning or work being carried out without the necessary consents. However, what transpired was that when the planning permission was granted, contrary to the planning permission granted, a skylight had been included in the roof of the property on the second floor in one of the bedrooms when the renovations took place. Right, so we've got a skylight that shouldn't be there. Now, this might ordinarily be classed as a permitted development, but in this case, the property was in a conservation area, and despite everyone's best efforts, or Ms. Ross's best efforts, having purchased the property, she was unable to get this to be waived. She was served with an enforcement notice and had to remove the window so this second bedroom had no windows at all. Therefore, that bedroom has to be converted into a bathroom, because there would have been a breach of building regulations had it remained a windowless bedroom. So she is then left with upstairs a bedroom and a bathroom rather than a bedroom and a bedroom. And that means she has to reconfigure the downstairs. But to cut a long story short, she's left with a spacious one-bed property rather than a two-bed property and all the consequences on value that that brings. And the basis of the defence was, look, the director saying, I wasn't aware of any breaches of planning permission, any breaches of building regulations, anything of that nature. I'm resident in Australia. I had subcontractors carry out the work. No one had served me with any enforcement notice at the time I'd purchased the property, etc., etc. But there wasn't a William Sindel exclusion clause. The judge relied heavily on the fact that in terms of who was in a position to discover this, it was the director, i.e. the seller, not Ms. Rossa, even though Ms. Rossa herself could have gone to the property, she could have seen the skylight, she could have looked up the plans and could have said, hang on, these plans don't match what was actually built. She could have seen that it was in a conservation area. The judge says, well, actually, no, because how would she be in a position to know that there wasn't a skylight before the renovations took place, and therefore it was just a continuation, that the skylight was a new thing that had been put in as a result. And the heavy burden that is placed on a seller with the consequence of the decision in William Sindel meant that this director, the other side of the world, was still obliged to carry out the necessary investigations to satisfy himself that what he was saying when he was filling out this TA6 was accurate. And so Ms. Rossa was successful. She was able to claim on the basis of negligent misrepresentation and was therefore able to claim damages. Her expert evidence was fantastically weak on this point, but the judge having found for her on the misrep point was obviously very keen to see that through and was able to look at the information and make a fairly broad brush conclusion about loss. And she was able to...
He had to scramble around a bit for it,
yeah,
didn't
he really did.
Case.
And, you know, you could see that he was doing his best. And another judge on another day would say, Ms. Rossa, you've got halfway there. You've proved your misrep, but you've not proved your loss. I think obviously there's a considerable degree of sympathy from Mr. Justice Zaccaroli to her about her predicament of ending up with a one-bed property, as you know, as we all have, right? Because, you know, being served with that enforcement notice after you purchased a property and not being able to have a second bedroom obviously is going to have an impact on value. And so...
Absolutely, common sense. And this sounds like something where I'm pretty sure, from my recollection of the judgment, the standard conditions of sale didn't feature as a head of claim, but I wonder whether or not there would have been an opportunity there, given that there is a material difference, presumably, between the description of the property as is and as it turned out to be.
Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, in the end, didn't need that because... there was negligent misrepresentation was made out on the facts. So there we go. I think it just where that case is useful, obviously useful for conveyancers acting for sellers, because this really rams home how important it is when you're filling out those forms to make sure that you actually know what you're saying is true and that you've gone and done some investigations. And I had a property misrep case last year, and it centered around issues around planning. And so I was looking at this recent decision of Rossa. And at the same time, I was selling my own flat. And so, you know, when it came to that particular question about are you aware of any other nearby planning permissions or anything, I was there on the register going through, reading everything, putting everything that I could possibly find down in this form, probably far more than I needed to, about sort of building developments that were happening sort of a couple of streets away. Better to be safe than sorry. And yeah, it's really important when you're acting for vendors to do that. But equally, if you're acting for a purchaser with buyer's regret who suddenly discovered certain things, And you have the other side saying, well, we didn't know about any of this. You know, we absolutely, as far as we knew, and even if they write on the form, to the best of our knowledge, no, that's not good enough. You can't caveat on the TA6 to say, to the best of my knowledge, because that, even, you know, William Sindel's very clear on that. Even if you say to the best of
my knowledge, it's not a magical sentence.
No,
it's not a magical,
it still implies
sort of fix all, is it? To say, to my best of my knowledge, there is no dry rot or knotweed or whatever it is.
Yeah, and to the best of my knowledge is interpreted as an implied representation that you have gone off and done these things and done these investigations and satisfied yourself, and that's why your knowledge is to the best of. So, yeah, there we go. Those are my thoughts on those couple of cases, but really useful ones, I think, for any of you practitioners who have a property misrep case. But headlines from me are, definitely think about your contract claim as an alternative to a misrep claim under Clause 7 of the standard conditions. Definitely think about the impact of William Sindel and look to see whether there is a William Sindel clause that tries to restrict that. Brittany, anything else from you?
I'd echo all of that, and then I'd add in, act promptly, because rescission can be very difficult to achieve after the event when you're dealing with property, and also if you're acting for the seller of property, to try and avoid misrep cases from even sort of getting off the ground, be wary about whether your clients are sort of creating unnecessary risks if they're putting together documents that they don't need to be putting together, that they haven't been asked for.
Final point for me, I think, yeah, just to reiterate something I said at the beginning, is that condition type misrep claims are very difficult, because for the reasons we've gone through, generally your remedy is against your surveyor. Generally the court will say caveat emptor unless you have the seller who's acted as a developer or a builder or anything like that. Those think long and hard before trying to pursue the seller, because you think the property is in less good condition than you'd hoped for.
Absolutely. It all comes down to the contract, in a way.
There we go. Okay, right, let's wrap it up there. We've gone on for quite long enough, but Brittany, thank you very much for having me on your show. I look forward...
Thank you for coming along.
Look forward to the next instalment. Okay, great.
Well, thank you very much for listening to The Real Estate Pod. If you'd like to find out more about St John's Chambers or to get in touch with us, go to www.stjohnschambers.co.uk.